Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. February 15th, episode number 52. This is a bonus edition podcasting. Hi everyone, my name is Kevin England, and I'm here today with something a little bit different. We're in between the normal cadence of episodes, and I'm throwing in a bonus here today that is on the topic of podcast production. I'm sorry to disappoint those who came for the normal run of events, but be rest assured, I have the next episode in the works and we'll be turning that around shortly. This episode is going to fulfill a promise that I made early on, and that is to take a break at one point and talk about the level of effort and background in the physical production of the podcast. I've been at this for 4 years or so, and I think I have enough experience to bring a detailed insight on what it takes to produce a podcast, and quite surprisingly, it is a lot. I've received a run of requests lately asking me for insights, guidance, and literally requests on how to get started, given some interests into getting into podcasting. This is for all that have asked questions, and for those who have been asking me to take the time and document this for posterity. So I have to admit I'm a little bit squeamish about this. As much as I enjoy doing the podcast and I do my own thing, I don't particularly like to make things about me, and not to be egotistical, but this is about me and what I do. I will add advice along the way on general principles, but throughout I'll use the production of the Beekeeper's Corner and my experiences to guide the conversation. There's some of this that opens the opportunity to let you know some of my background, so I'll cover that in summary along the way, as it provides insights as to how the podcast came about and how it operates. So remember, no bees, just podcasting. But wait. Before you go away, if you're thinking this won't be interesting because it's not about bees, perhaps you might stay a bit and give it a whirl. I'll tell you that this is somewhat like a behind-the-music special, if you want to think of it that way. No bees, but it could be interesting. You have my permission, if this doesn't interest you, to turn it off at any time, but I would suggest that you might find this something to listen to, so on to our show. I don't really have a general sense of how long this is going to take. I have a lot to cover. I have some pretty extensive notes. So some of the topics I intend to cover in the next hour or so is a review on the why one does a podcast and discussion on style and approach, insights on the research performed when it's applicable, tips and tricks, or maybe you could say advice from someone who actively does this, some insight on the time investment involved. I'll finish off with a step-by-step process of a day in the life of producing an episode so you can have a first-hand glimpse of what takes place. And toward the end, I'll spend some time on things that I use in the production of the podcast, equipment, software, and services. And then I'll end off with some final insights. So let's dive right in, shall we? So the first of five segments is why. Why would one become a podcaster? One of the first things you wrestle with is getting started. I tell myself I did this because I wanted to record my beekeeping exploits. It's true that that is what motivated me, but honestly, I had gotten away from internet TV broadcasting regularly, and I was looking for an outlet because on the inside I really enjoyed the broadcast and production side, and I wanted to find some way to channel my creativity. There was always this time that I had a notion, and I had a period of time before I started, I'll call it the envisioning stage, where I thought about what I would do, what I would say, and more importantly, how I would find time and space to record and disseminate the episodes. With gumption, I recorded my first episodes and never looked back, or for the most part. I must admit there are times when I question myself as to why I should continue, and was doing this relevant and a productive use of my time. In retrospect, I think it's only natural to evaluate that question on occasion, kind of like the Forrest Gump running. One day I might answer that I've done my part and shut it down. The reason I share this with you is so that when you face the crossroad in the back of your mind, you'll know that this is a natural progression of things if you ever take on the task of podcasting. At minimum, I'll tell you it's okay to debate your sanity and certainly how crazy you are for the work that you put in. For me, podcasting affords a natural channel for immersion into a topic. And I guess anything that I've done in life, all of my passions, I've gone big. There's a sentimental side of me that hopes one day my boys will consider beekeeping and they'll always have these recordings to remember me by. And they're a pretty accurate depiction of my character as I think about it, so it might be cool for them to have this catalog to reflect back on. In the end, I have a natural desire to be helpful and to teach, I guess. It's in my DNA, and the truth is, I like the interaction, the yin and yang of putting something out there and receiving the feedback on exchange of ideas. Perhaps one day this will lead to a long-lasting impact to how bees will be kept, and that would be my legacy, and that'd be cool. I make no bones about it either. My hope is to hone this insight to possibly, maybe, perhaps, do something commercial with the body of knowledge that I've acquired, the word is, maybe someday, but it would be cool if that didn't happen either. So a lot of that was about me, but the fact of the matter is, if you're going to start your podcasting, you have to think about you, why you would do it. You really have to be motivated in order to take this on, and you have to understand why you're doing it and how you meet your objectives. So enough about that. Let's go to segment number two, style and approach. So style and approach, my style is conversational by choice. I produce my episodes with the notion that I'm sitting at a table and you're just across from me and we're having a dialogue. Yeah, one could say you're talking to yourself, Kevin. Seriously, my approach is to present the topic like I'm having a dialogue with a hobbyist beekeeper. I'm not catering to the commercial person, but there's no reason they couldn't listen. I often have the idea that they would get a kick out of what I say, but I know going in that they do what they do, and we hobbyists, well, sometimes we have to learn the hard way. And sometimes, get this, our way is better but not practical for them. We have different objectives, so I don't lose sleep over this. So why conversational? My objective with the dialogue is to try and sum up the salient points of a topic and prevent you from having to wade through the minutia. It's an added bonus and quite frankly very exhilarating to me to bring things that are new and exciting, and I honestly just can't wait to share them with you. For me, I envision me and you talking about something that is of common interest and sharing thoughts, ideas, and notions. Being conversational is harder than it looks, but to me the secret sauce of the delivery is that it allows the podcast to flow. As a podcaster, this might not be for you, and this either works or it doesn't. Another way to say this is some people can do this and some can't. So what if you can't? I have to say criticism comes with the territory. I would say don't do this if you don't have the confidence to live with criticism or learn that you were flat wrong sometimes. Fortunately for me, errors have been few and far between. That is as far as I know. People send me occasional corrections, but I don't recall any major gaffe. Will it happen? Yes, probably someday. My thought is you can't avoid it, but you can make it an anomaly. My advice, don't do your podcast half-assed. Do the research and put your best effort, or don't do it at all. People will be brutal in their assessment, trust me on that. There's a phrase, no wine before it's time. My take is no topic before it's researched. Illustratively, I'll make this up, but these things happen. Let's say that I've had the notion to do a spring topic. I put in hours and hours only to shelve it because it wasn't ready and we're into summer. My hope for these things is that maybe in the following spring I could bring it out, but sometimes it's a total loss and that just comes with the territory. There are ways to do half-finished things and not waste your work, but you have to presuppose or suggest when you're doing those. You really can't wing it. You have to present your thoughts and ideas with no conclusions and allow it to stand that way. So one thing about doing this is don't profess to be the expert, unless you are. What I don't do is play the role of the expert spouting chapter and verse. My guidance is always deliver with humility and from a point of summing up information with the intent to share, not as a source of truth. Except where I've learned and feel comfortable to provide my own viewpoint and then tell it with a little more authority and profess some expertise because of empirical knowledge, I don't go crazy about professing somebody else's work is mine. It's just some place you don't want to go. I have perspective that there are people doing real research and with empirical knowledge, and unless I quit my job and do bees all day, every day, it's better to lean on them for the insights. That being said, I'm in bees enough and immersed enough, hopefully, to discern BS from proper information. Hopefully, I've demonstrated that I've done my homework, but when people think I'm wrong, I hear about it, and I'm not shy about admitting if I was wrong on something. I'm proud that I don't get called out very often, and I can't tell you how many times I've done research on something and come away with an understanding that I think is pretty sound. And then I go see a Tom Seeley or somebody else, and I hear him repeat an unsolicited viewpoint that was aligned in what I said in one of my episodes from the past. For one, it's gratifying, but it also validates that you're disseminating proper information, something I'm always pleased to have happen. I can't tell you any time I listen to a Tom Seeley, a Dennis Van Engelsdorp, Michael Bush, or anything else. I'm always evaluating their take on it to see if what I've said is correct. Are they correct? I presume most of the time they are. They could be repeating the same misinformation I am. But a lot of times I think the people in the know, I like to hear what they have to say, and especially when they repeat things that I've come up with. That's good karma, I guess. So as with anything you're doing, you got to get zen with it. You hear that one of these things people rank as the most nerve-wracking thing to do is speak in public. Want to know a secret? I'm no different. Yeah, let me give you a little context to that. I've done more than my fair share of teaching and public speaking in life, and I'll stand up just about anywhere, anytime. But here's another funny thing about this. I hate crowds. I hate it. Take me to Disney, and I'm miserable. Take me to a standing room only venue, I'm miserable. Can't stand being around 10 billion people. But if I have to stand and speak to a large crowd, it's no big deal, with one minor exception. I'm terribly uncomfortable if I am unprepared. In my book, there's nothing more nerve-wracking than standing in front of a crowd, and it's almost like standing there naked. I've given speaking engagements that went horribly wrong. Last-minute stand-in stuff with no prep, and while I could do it, I hate it with a passion. So here's the most valuable advice I can give you about putting yourself out there. Get comfortable about what you're going to talk about. Talk to yourself. Think through what you have to say and where you are short. Run it past friends to fill in the gaps. Mine ideas and learn insights by always listening to what people are talking about. Because whatever it is, whatever's interesting to the broader audience, that's what people are discussing. This is going to sound a little odd, but I often think my number one sounding board is my friend Bob Kloss. He and I bounce ideas that we speak of, and I'm guessing when he listens to what I talk about on these podcasts, he's hearing it all over again. He might even be hearing some of his words parroted back because he's so insightful on many things that we're talking about. And to that end, I've been seeking him out to come and join me on occasion for the podcast. But honestly, the backstory on this is many of the topics are discussed between he and I, and he tends to fill in those gaps for me. He's one of the people I count on. So you know I'm uncomfortable when I'm not prepared, so you can be rest assured that an adequate amount of thought and research goes into just about any topics that have been covered in detail here. So let me talk about the approach. And the thing about it is breaking it down. So now you know what you want to say, but you're not clear on how to present it. My advice is you'll never go wrong by breaking the topics into digestible chunks. Like writing a good research paper, delivery has a beginning, a middle, and an end. By the way, I often think that my episodes at times are akin to writing a research paper. It's ironic from a person who hated doing that in school, but I seriously find myself doing a lot of research and writing a paper pretty much. That's what a script is for an episode. I think about the beginning, introduction, and make a point as to why the topic is relevant. I provide the insights through the middle that support the objective of what you're trying to convey, always keeping in mind that the middle should result in the desired outcome. You want to conclude with a summary of what was said and why it was relevant. Upon finishing, provide follow-ons as necessary, and always, I think a good practice, provide links and resources back to your sources and further information where it's relevant. Now, here's something I struggle with a little bit, but keep the duration to a reasonable time frame, but don't leave them wanting for more. I tend to overdo things and go on forever. I know I'm bad about that, but, you know, this is an adage that I learned from doing a lot of training things, and forgive the French here, but I tend to overdo sessions, and people say that the mind can only absorb what the ass can endure. So you got to keep it short and brief. See, even that I couldn't keep short and brief. So rarely can you get by with anything on a podcast without doing research. And one of my last things has to do with how I do research. First thing is you have to be organized and have a system. It is so easy to get yourself into the position where you have scraps all over the place. There's nothing more infuriating than knowing that you have some insight, but you can't find it. It's like losing your keys. Develop your go-to sources and collect your notes in an organized fashion. I often develop an outline of topics and then use Microsoft OneNote to keep them organized. I have a general topic area collection bucket sorted by broad topic areas. Then I have separate collection area for each individual episode. I could literally go back to episode, say, 20, where I started this, and show you the sources and topic information for every episode organized in a fashion in which they were delivered. So sources for beekeeping podcasts, or anything else, I suppose, I use Google Scholar, beekeeping forums for ideas, blogs, news sites, newsletters, and probably a dozen other types of inputs. Through the years, things come and go. Some are references, and some are definitive sources. So another way to say this is I'm not in the habit of quoting a John Smith from a forum thread, but I will quote research articles, the Merrick Guide, and other documented, substantiated sources. This is not to say that relevant ideas are not in the Bee Source or Bee Master forums. Let me not be a snob about that. There are incredibly insightful people in there, not to mention well-known industry people like Michael Palmer, Walt Wright, Michael Bush, among others. It's just that most of the time I'll use what's being talked about as a jump-off point to a different place to find the research on it. In the end, always, always be prepared to cite your sources and never put yourself in a position to be ashamed to admit them. And of course, whenever it comes to research, there's a tendency in human nature to craft something for your own belief. Be careful about that. Present the facts, stay with them, even if they don't support your conclusion. Part of the fun in research is finding out that you were wrong and providing the insights that change your way that you think about things. So let's move away from style and approach and go to segment number 3, which is suggestions, advice, and insights. I would advise using a template to collect your thoughts or whatever works for you and following a format. You have to come up with a system that becomes your own method. I mentioned this a moment ago. It's my belief that people like to understand the format of the show, so have one. Our show has a cadence to it, and most successful shows that I'm familiar with follow some sort of construct. So, to that end, come up with a generalized template or outline. I use a Word template for all of the episodes that I do. It's my own creation and has the overall structure of a typical episode. If you listen to me, you know that I've evolved the show and its format, but now I have a formula that works for me. Segments, roundtables, the little chime to signify a move from one topic to another. From a style standpoint, there are a few things that are unique to the show and give it character. The local Hive Report's a signature, along with occasional Kevin moments. My suggestion is you will need to find your own place in the world. In the early days, I used podcast-ready music clips between segments. I really liked it because it allowed some style to be interjected, but it was too much work. To find the music on the sites, to cut it down to 1-minute interludes, and then to provide proper credit. Fun, but not productive use of time. You have to be brutal about this. When you write your copy, write it one day, go back, read it again, and cut, edit, make it shorter, wherever you can. So, for the music thing, in some respects, if I had a production team, I might consider putting it back in. In other respects, it was too much time, and it really didn't have anything to do with beekeeping. It was production value. From a practical matter, it had to go. So, concerning the template, each thought is outlined in a bulleted fashion. Bulleted in a logical section as opposed to run-on sentences which are hard to read like copy and easy to mess up. Sometimes you literally refer to these things straight through, and referring to sentences while you're trying to read the sentence and talk is really difficult for most people, unless you're a true trained professional. That is a complicated thing to do, so write little snippets. Sometimes you don't even write the thoughts out. You just literally put one or two words to guide yourself through whatever the script will be or whatever the thoughts will be. So another suggestion is listen to how you sound. Be aware of this throughout and keep tabs on the energy you bring to the program. One thing that I do to inject energy is to be animated when I talk. If you could see me, you would laugh. I'm using my hands. I'm gesticulating at some points. I laugh out loud. I get mad. When you use animation in delivery, it makes a better product because the delivery rings true. And don't be afraid to call yourself out. Leaving mistakes in and laughing at them, especially when they're funny, it's almost like a blooper reel. Right through the middle. Yeah, I know. I'm a bit campy, and if you met me in person, you know that's my candor. I'm not overly serious, so it would be disingenuous for me to try and be, you know, the evening news kind of guy. And one other benefit of this campiness, quite frankly, is it takes a lot of time to be perfect, to re-record and cut and edit and do whatever. Sometimes I am really bad, and believe me, I've gone back and listened to some of the episodes, and they were a little too far off. But there are times when I leave it in, and it's perfectly fine. It just shows personality. There are occasions where I make mistakes, and I go back and re-record certain little clips. You'll find your balance along the way. And that really is about listen to how you sound, and how you want to be perceived. Sometimes when you listen to yourself after you record, you find yourself being very critical. And it takes a while to get used to how you produce things. You'll get there. So I talked about doing research, and this little snippet is about know thy topic, and I mean a different way to that. Immerse yourself in the topic or learn how to facilitate the expert. My podcast is singularly focused. Not all podcasts are that way. Mine is, and I choose to immerse myself in anything beekeeping, and I mean anything. I cover a broad array of topics, but generally everything is tied to beekeeping. Some podcasts have a topic du jour, and you may have to familiarize yourself with the topic so you can get the most out of your guest or the analysis you're working on. So if you think about someone like Terry Gross, National Public Radio, a tremendous figure, she could be interviewing people who are Hollywood stars. Next time she could be interviewing the guy who landed the plane on the Hudson, and so on. Her topics vary so much, and she really probably does an incredible amount of research to make it look so easy the way she does. So as much as I talk about flubs and whatever, the fact of the matter is you should really be good at what you do when you're trying to present an idea and a topic. And reading words fluently is extremely important. And I can't suggest any more that reading copy and practicing reading is just a skill you cannot do without. I spent time in high school at a radio station, WCVH 90.5 in Flemington. Yep. My high school offered a class in careers in broadcasting. I always loved the radio voices when I was a kid. 77 WABC. I idolized Dan Ingram, if you know that. You have to be a New York person to understand who that is. He was the voice of radio when I was a kid, and I always wanted to emulate his style and his voice. Music radio, WABC. Yeah, sorry. I was in the high school station, and while most of it was really kids just goofing off, and I mean god-awful shows, I wanted to be a broadcaster, and I had a mentor who coached us on the ins and outs. It was there that I learned to read copy. I could read commercials, we did public service announcements, and we read the weather, we read the news, things like that. Some of them were terrible, but over time we got better. And when I say we, I'm talking about my brother Keith and I. We did a 1950s music station in the 1980s. We had a really neat pattern because we grew up listening to American Graffiti. So we went and did the research on the songs and the backstory. There was so much of it available. We would present a little factoid about a song and then we would play it. And one night we got a call from WCAU Radio out of Philadelphia asking us about the format, and they couldn't believe that it was two high school kids. And lo and behold, shortly after that, WOGL, the oldies station, launched in Philadelphia. I always wonder if there was some sort of connection. I guess it was wishful thinking of a dreamy high school kid. But we did have a star call in who sang 16 Candles and did the promo for us. He lived in the region. He heard our radio station and loved it and did, "Hi, my name is JT Carter from the Crests. You remember 16 Candles? I listen to WCVH and we love this song. 16 Candles." All right. Yeah, it takes me back. So I was always self-conscious about how, yeah, let me come back to topic, I sounded. And so I would go home and read the newspaper out loud and listen to the ways that commercials were delivered on commercial radio. Now, I went to art school after high school and got out of broadcasting, but eventually I became a 911 communications operator and was on the police, fire, and rescue radio every day. Our call sign was KYQ 55300. I stopped that in 2000, but never lost the itch to get behind the radio. In 2006, I got behind the microphone again, and I did a stint on online TV as a broadcaster of NASCAR-style races. So why am I telling you all this? It's strictly to illustrate that I have a lot of practice. Now, you don't have to do all these things that I did. you can literally read from a magazine. Popular Mechanics works. Oprah magazine, whatever tickles your fancy. You could read Bee Culture if you're a beekeeper and you want to do that. It's just that thing of getting ready to read and then find two steps to this. One is read properly, read it, and read it without error. And the second one is learn how to build inflection in it, how to emphasize certain points, how to create something more than a monotone delivery. Because if you're on a podcast, your voice is all that you have. It's a rare person who can be fluent behind a microphone and read copy without practice. Now, some people are naturals, but practice is a really good idea. So there's one other thing about reading copy. To emphasize my point, you might be surprised to know that even now as I talk to you, I'm reading a prepared script. Pretty much, literally, word for word, with some ad-libbing, and you are probably none the wiser. I have what I'm told is a gift, and that is that I can capture a thought in writing, and word for word, it's aligned with how I would say it normally, out loud, in conversation. And for that reason, I could read this to you, and you think I was just talking out loud. Whatever your skill set is, record yourself and analyze what you sound like. Use a discerning ear towards what you would change and what you don't like. And as terrible as this sounds, let other people listen to it and give you honest feedback. Look for bad habits, ums and ahs, words that you use too often. There is nothing worse than listening to someone who's running 18 ums an hour. That is just the most infuriating thing ever. You need to recognize those bad habits. Compare yourself against someone on TV or the radio. Use their styles. It's okay. That's how most people get to it, is they listen to the evening broadcaster, Alex Trebek on Jeopardy, whatever the case may be. These people are widely emulated. So that being said, everybody has to start somewhere. So when you start out, go back and listen to your delivery and figure out how to modify it to hone your craft, but don't be too crazy critical. I guess the best advice is to say it's not the 6 o'clock news. It's a podcast with friends. So we'll close down this segment with time and cost investment. As far as the time investment goes, count on twice as much time as you think. Now, with that being said, don't rush. Take your time and then time your take. Dedicate yourself to the job at hand. Think about what you're going to present, and over time you'll get a handle on the time investment needed. Sometimes you can do it in one session, literally, like this one. I wrote this script and I'm sitting here recording it in one shot. And other times you'll need to do a series of recordings. I guess it all depends on the content and how it comes about. I could share that I spend anywhere from 3 to 4 hours a week easily, and when there's a complicated topic, it can be done double or triple the time. I think there are certain episodes that stand out, and you could tell which ones I put in countless hours to put together. You know, the funny thing is, there are some that have segments that take me months of sessions and research to put together. My simple advice is build a schedule in your life, find that time away that doesn't impede on the family, and get yourself into the zone and accomplish your goals. So for me, Sunday night is the time. As I sit here at 10:44 p.m. recording, my family's in bed, and we happen to have off tomorrow, which is great and wonderful. It's President's Day in the U.S., so I can afford to do this. But usually Sunday nights come unencumbered. I said time and cost. I guess cost is a misnomer. I don't want to say what I've spent on this endeavor for fear that maybe Sharon is going to hear this. Most years, the hosting charges for my website are the most money spent, but sometimes equipment investments outrun that. I buy beekeeping equipment so I can have real-world experience. I buy podcasting equipment so I can sound professional and produce easier and do things like that. I equate this to what other people spend on their hobbies. this is my hobby, so it's okay if I spend a little discretionary money. I just have to keep that in check, and you can spend a lot of money doing this. But the fact of the matter is, for, I'm going to say conservatively, $500, a microphone, some software, some hosting, you could be up and running and put a pretty good show out. So don't let costs dissuade you. Build yourself a little bit of a slush fund, a budget, and then go get it done. Towards the end of this episode, I'll tell you about the equipment that I have so you can have an idea of what it takes. Okay, I don't think this would be complete if I didn't give you a day in the life process. So let's go to segment number 4. So segment number 4, the process starts with recording. I'm literally going to jump right in. Except for the rare occasions that I record in my truck, which I've gotten away from, incidentally, for safety and quality reasons, I always go into a recording session with an agenda. I open Audacity on one screen and perform some test recordings to sanity check the levels on my computer. I have a routine of setting the volume on my computer and then setting levels in Audacity, my recording software, and then I record some samples and sanity check them to make sure that I don't overmodulate. That's Radio Turk for blowing out the speakers. This all presupposes that whatever I'm going to talk about has already been covered, which I just spoke about, so I didn't include that part here. I then open a template starter project that I created in Audacity, and it has the opening music and the chimes built in that I can rearrange for every episode that I have. This is running full screen Audacity on the first monitor that I have, and trust me when I tell you, you need a large monitor and the space to work with this tool. On the second monitor that I have, I'm running dual screens, I open my notes via OneNote and I open my episode template. Concerning the template, sometimes I write the entire episode word for word, and other times I work from a couple bullet points and riff the whole episode. To me, the content that being presented lends itself to the approach being used. Some things I literally can speak from the cuff, and other times when I'm doing the research stuff, I have to follow a script because it's way too technical and complicated to remember, especially in detail. So it's not unusual for certain segments or roundtables for me to open a website or open some recipe or some other source to read from and refer to. Every single episode is different. The conventional thing for me to do is sit down to do an episode and record it from start to finish. The Audacity tool records what I'll refer to as a track. I record each component of the podcast on its own track in the tool. The opening music is one track, the episode announcement is track 2, the welcome and agenda is track 3, the local hive report is track 4, and so on. There's a method to this, which I'll explain in a bit. I start with the opening, which conveys the episode information. I add a diversified welcome that reflects the mood I'm in and sets the stage for the way I'll deliver the content. I'll provide an opening, often off the cuff and sometimes written. Also, if there's a topic of the moment to add on top, like for example when we had Hurricane Sandy, I threw in a little blurb about that, and then I got right into the episode information. I bridge to the agenda of what I'm going to talk about, and then segue into the local hive report, which is the signature way to get the episode started and breaks the ice. For the physical recording, I hit the record button and talk into the microphone. If I screw something up and need to go back, I stop the recording. I have two choices. I delete the track and start from scratch, or I put a marker at the last good spot and I delete everything thereafter and pick up recording where I left off. So let's say I want to pick up where I left off. I don't want to delete the whole track. I'm somewhere in the middle of something. You start the recording in Audacity by making sure you have the track selected, go to the end of it using the tool, and you hold the shift button when you click the record. It will pick up the recording right where you left off. Now, a discerning ear can listen to my podcasts and find out every once in a while where I've come in after the fact and recorded something. the volume is different, the pace is different, the term is different. But most of the time, as I have a run, I am paying attention to the delivery and cadence, sound, position I am from the microphone. And this takes a lot of practice so that when you start over with that same type of tone and inflection. It takes practice, and all I could say is that I listen to an episode at times and I pick up where I've done this. Sometimes it's so painfully obvious, but a lot of times I know that I've done something and I go back and listen, and you would be none the wiser. So again, something that takes practice with the tools that you use. I record segment one and then I stop the recording. I grab the chime channel that was pre-recorded and I move it below the segment track. And using the utilities of the tool, you can grab that little clip of sound and move it to the end of the segment that was just recorded. The tool, which is cool, provides an auto-align feature that snaps it to the end of the segment recording above. Then you hit the end of recording session and hit record, and next thing you know, you're recording right after the sound snippet. The tool allows you to manipulate the sound snippets, move, delete, erase, and so on. And they're imperative to learn. You need to take time to learn your software for recording, no matter what you're using. I record segment after segment, saving as I go. And knock on wood, I've only had one or two catastrophes. Catastrophe, huh? That means I put a lot of work into a recording and the tool crashes and it goes poof. So I'm 41 minutes into this recording yet, and I haven't saved it yet. I'm dancing the dance. So don't do what I do. Save, and save often. In fact, I'm going to stop right here for a second and go save it. Okay, all is right with the world. You know, one other thing I'm thinking about as I save it. I have my files on my network. And if you're using Audacity and you're recording a lot of, or any recording tool, and you're recording a lot of sound, it tends to have to write to the disk a lot, and moving it over the network doesn't work. You have to record it on the local drive on your computer, and using an SSD drive is a better way to do it, because the write is extremely fast. It takes a lot of horsepower to do this for your computer. Okay. So I run through all of the content and finish recording what I'm working on. Along the way, if I promise a link, I make a note of it. I'm not always perfect, and there have been a number of times I've done a post-release screening only to recall that I forgot something for the show note. Rule of thumb here is make a note of it while you're recording. It's far easier to do it all together when you're preparing the episode versus going back later and purposely fixing something. I've gotten a lot better with this since I went to the template format. I go track by track and look for errors. I'm looking to see if the tracks overlap, if there are gaps after one track of dead air. I make sure that literally each track butts up against the other one on every recording. I do a final save and then I export the file to a preordained location where I keep all my files. I save the file with a standard naming convention that is the episode number and the date. This makes the file sort in order, and the convention makes it easier for me to consistently link it in my website without having to go look at the file name. You find these things that save you time all the way through in your process. So now I have a recording and the file is done, but this is really the first part of the journey. I provide the show notes for all of my episodes. And the secret is that while this is for you, it's for me too. I often have to refer back, and it's a table of contents for me to quickly index a topic and listen to it, something that I've covered before. Earlier I said each segment and roundtable topic has its own track. The reason I do this is I can select a track and give it a label for a reference later on. The more important reason is that at the bottom of the tool tells you the beginning and end times of the track, and that's how I get the data for the table of contents in the show notes. I click track by track and put the times in my show note template. My show notes serve as the record of the episode, and I literally cut and paste the show notes and links from the template to my website. Another time-saving tip. So now I'm at a point where I get ready for the promote to production. I go into the file system and I open the file with a utility called MP3 tag tool that I use. This sets the metadata about the episode. Date, title, author, album, track, genre. The title is the episode number followed by a dash in the episode title in the meta tag. And a quick side note about the title. I started this so that I could differentiate one episode from another. They're kind of goofy names, but they do serve a purpose. They're generally playful in theme. Some might say they're stupid, but I figure I have more important things to worry about than if someone doesn't like my titles. I put my name in the artist field. The album is Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. The track is the episode number. And the last thing I do is load cover artwork and save the file. You may or may not have noticed, I started putting numbers on the cover artwork for each episode. I think it adds a nice touch, and it shows up in my file system with the episode number like a billboard, so it has a practical side too. So I know this tagging stuff is minutia, but in the end, here's the key insight about it. This is probably one of the most underestimated tasks for podcasting. What shows up in iTunes, in your RSS feed, in your podcasting software, and so on, is this information. If you get it wrong, it's infuriating to your user. One thought about how I do this should enlighten you. I always use the same album name, the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. This means that all episodes show up under that album in your software. Some people give a different album name for each episode, and people get livid that they have episodes strewn all over their music collection. Believe me when I say this, people delete podcasts because of this. I use the episode number for the track number. The insight here is you click on the album and all of the episodes are listed in order, like the songs of an album. Do this how you want, but know that it does make a difference. So now I'm to the point where I'm going to make the file public. I update the episode data on the website. I won't bore you with the details of that, but it takes about 30 minutes each time. One nuance is that you have to pay attention. No matter what, you have to pay attention to your RSS feed. This is the listing of the internet that iTunes and other things come and get your information about your podcast. It's XML-based technology, and it is not forgiving whatsoever if you make a mistake in the formatting. Put a paragraph or quotation in the wrong place, it will not read the file. And another footnote on this is there's a format that's dominated by Apple, but prescribed to by the rest of the world. It's literally prescriptive on how the information you enter is presented. In short, when you open iTunes, and just about any other podcast software for that matter, you see all this information about the episode from the RSS file. Now, it's too complicated to tell you about the details on this. You could find someone to do this for you or roll up your sleeves and dig into the documentation from Apple. And as much as I am admittedly an Apple fan, you have to read Apple's documentation on this because they are the kings. And that's exactly what I did. Step by step, line by line, field by field in the XML, you have to go follow Apple's directions. There are some services that can handle this for you, but I've never gone their route, so I can't say how it works and what they charge. I save all the changes I'm going to make to my website, and I SFTP all the content, including the MP3 file, to my web server. I've submitted my podcast RSS to Apple and other outlets, and they are coming back and checking periodically to see whether I posted anything new. This is the reason why sometimes you'll see it show up in, and I know this because I look, it'll be in Apple one day, it'll be in Xbox another day, it'll go in Stitcher another day. They come back at various times. I can tell you Xbox comes back all the time. Apple comes back when they're good and ready. I don't know why that is, but it could be a couple days after an episode is released that Apple picks it up. The only action left now is for you to notice the new episode and download it, or hit play on the subscribed episode that you have in your podcast tool. So that's a day in the life, and I'm right in the middle of it all as to how a podcast gets produced. And rinse, lather, and repeat for 50 times. That's what it's been like. At some point, I've mentioned I'd love to see the website of it. You know, I like producing the episode, but I hate all the rigmarole that follows it. I try to make that easier than I can. If you're thinking about simplifying the page or whatever, but, you know, understand, this is the takeaway. Recording the podcast is one fraction of all that it takes to produce all of this. You deal with the email and all the other stuff as a side effect of putting a podcast out there. So know what you're getting yourself vested into. Okay, let's move to the final segment, segment number 5. And talk a little bit about the equipment in play and software. So segment number 5 is about equipment. It's about what I use. I'll start with hardware, but I don't think I could get by without talking about software and services that I use in the overall program. I'm a fan of Paul Thurrott from the Supersite from Windows. Paul provides a feature on his Supersite blog that tells you what equipment he uses in his daily travels. This is an homage to him because I always find it interesting in what he's got, and as a peer in the podcast industry, we're uniquely similar, if that's a way to say it. A lot of the stuff and same trials and tribulations, I found that he's using the same tools almost verbatim, so that's kind of cool that we both found our way in the same place. He's been doing this longer than I have, and he's got a lot more expensive equipment than I have, but here we go. So recording, I use a Shure 58 Beta microphone. This thing's kind of like the Chevy van of microphones. People use it for recording in bands and this type of thing or whatever. It's a middle-of-the-road, good, sturdy microphone, produces good sound, and it's not $1 million. I also have a Shure 8900 WD microphone. It was the one I started out with. I don't use it very often, but it is a reasonably good microphone. My microphone's sitting in something called an on-stage stand. It's just something simply that gets the microphone up and out of the way while I'm talking. Some people use the boom microphones like a lamp thing that you pull over to you and it hangs. I find I tried that, and I tend to see squeaking, and it was always in the way, and I just eventually went to a stand microphone. My microphone has a windscreen over it. It prevents the popping of the P's and the D's. And in recording, I'm using 64 gig SD cards. I have 5 of them in the house. I use them for both recording the podcast, archiving stuff, remote recording, so on. I have a Logitech C15 HD webcam. It's a pretty good quality webcam. Sometimes I do video podcasting, and I've seen and used HP and IBM, old IBM, and they're just terrible. You look terrible, you sound terrible. So if you're going to do this, it's one of those things that you need to invest in, a good webcam. I can't forget my HTC 8X Windows phone. I'm using it all the time to record notes to myself. And every once in a while, I just sit down on the table and hit record and record what's going on around me that I can refer back to. I feel like a reporter sometimes in the way that I use my phone and capture sound. And I'm looking forward to buying a replacement for this next week. I'm going to get a Nokia Lumia Icon phone, a 929 5-inch phone. So excited. This thing also has a microphone array, incredible camera. So I'm going to up my game there. I'm going to be very happy about that. So when you talk about remote research and interviews and things like that, I have a Zoom H2 recorder. That's XOOM H2 recorder. I also use a Radio Shack 17-855 wireless phone recording controller. This is a neat little contraption. I don't even know if Radio Shack makes it. I found it off of eBay. You plug it into your wireless phone, and you plug it into your computer, and Audacity picks it up. You use a second wireless phone. I have multiples in the house. And when you're talking to someone on the phone, it's recording the conversation from both sides. I've looked at a bunch of different solutions for this, and one of the main reasons to have a phone recording thing is a lot of people, especially the old salts in beekeeping, don't have computer technology, they don't use Skype, they don't have microphones, they don't have that kind of stuff, but everybody has a telephone. When you're using this thing, don't use speakerphone, and make sure the person on the other side is not on a cell phone. I have Gozintus of every shape and size. What's it goes into? This goes into that, and that goes into this. Everything, every type of cord, from quarter inch to 3.5 millimeter to HDMI to whatever, you need cables and cables and cables, reams of them, for whatever you're going to be working on. You have a pretty good prosumer video camera. I debated whether or not I was going to use an SLR or buy a camcorder format, and I settled on the camcorder format. I use a Panasonic X920M sitting on a Vista tripod with a quick release mount. I like the way this thing works in the context of being able to hook a microphone to it, being able to zoom. I'm just comfortable with that format. I know a lot of people are using SLRs now, dual purpose. It's become a camcorder, but I find the lenses and everything really expensive, and I just didn't need that much complexity. To complement that, I do have a point-and-shoot camera. It's a Panasonic Lumix ZS30, 14-megapixel camera with a 20x optical zoom. I am just astonished at how good this camera is. And it's so small, fits in your pocket. This is a camera that shoots incredible video. The audio is great. The pictures are phenomenal. The zoom is just incredible. The only thing it's not good at is low light. And sometimes you find yourself inside and you're shooting and you're not getting anything of quality. But for the most part, from a camera standpoint, I don't know what else you could want from it. The Beekeepers Association purchased a Sony UWP V6 lavalier microphone set. I've mentioned this a couple times. It's invaluable, especially when you're shooting video or trying to get audio somewhere. It serves two purposes. It allows you to prevent your camera from picking up the person who's hacking and coughing and banging and talking out in the back audience while you're trying to get whoever is presenting up in the front of the room. The other thing that it's useful for is the other side, when you have somebody talking and you plug it into a speaker. As I said in my last episode, it really works well. For me, I use it goes into where whatever is going in the transmitter is coming through the receiver, and one side's going out to a speaker, and I use a splitter to do an import into the camera, and it works really well. So all the media that you shoot, audio, video, and whatever other formats, photographs, they have to be processed by a computer system, and my computer system's home-built. It's got a lot of horsepower. It's an i7 Intel processor. I've got an 8 gig of RAM, an NVIDIA GeForce GTX 580 display adapter. I used to use separate sound cards, but I've gotten away from that. I think the sound cards in here have done a pretty good job. The Realtek ones that come on a soundboard are as good as any of the Sound Blaster ones and don't come with all the driver complications. It's kind of strange that you record a podcast and you could use the default ones, but I've tried both and don't see any discernible difference. So from a complexity standpoint, I'm going with the onboard sound. I mentioned before I have dual 27-inch Samsung S27C390 monitors. These things are phenomenal. I can't tell you how productive it is to have dual monitors, especially when you're recording. Right now I have Audacity wide open on one screen and I'm looking at my notes on the other. there's just no way to squeeze it all onto one screen and get it large enough that you could see what the heck you're doing. You got to have good speakers. Maybe this doesn't have anything to do with the podcast, but I have Logitech Z560 speakers. These things crank. And a lot of times you're trying to capture stuff that people give you, they give you business cards and photographs and handouts and flyers. I use a Canon CanoScan 8400F flatbed scanner for that type of stuff. I also have a Canon MG5220 printer. It's an okay printer. It's got wireless and it's got a scanner on it too, which I never use. But you need to be able to print and do other things that way too to support your notes and things like that. So that's it for the hardware side. Software to produce the program, I talked about Audacity. You have to go look that up. It's free software. I also use a product called AVS, the number 4 for you. AVS for you. I use AVS video editor, audio editor, video converter. This stuff, it's kind of funny. It's been out there for a long time. I always thought it was kind of spam. And then I bought it, and it's just astounding what you get. If you buy the unlimited license, you will get a number of products that will certainly fulfill every need you need for media management. I'm using this for audio conversions, for video conversions, the stuff I post to YouTube, things like that. Invaluable software. I mentioned the MP3 tag editor. I don't think that software is made anymore, but the one I use I really like. There's a bunch of different ones out there. Graphics are just a side part of it, design. I use Adobe CS Suite, but primarily Photoshop and Illustrator. Of course, you have Adobe PDF for website documents. You can't get by without Microsoft Office. For me, it's about Microsoft. I can't use OpenOffice or any of those other things. I use Word for my templates, OneNote for my notes, Outlook for the email, of course. There's times where Excel comes into play and all the other Office tools. There's one other utility that comes with Windows. It's a Microsoft snipping tool. I use that probably 10 times a week. I'm surprised how much screen grabs and things like that you're doing. I should note that I have a Windows Home server. What that is a separate little server sitting on my network. All my media and everything is backed up to that. And then I'm running something called CrashPlan, the other competitor to that that's widely known as Carbonite. These are online services that back up to the cloud for CrashPlan, unlimited backup, 24/7. I have terabytes of data on my network. And this thing just runs in the background all the time. I get reports, and I have gone back and done backups. And this little public service announcement, if you're backing up inside your house, and God forbid something happens, a house burns down, hurricane happens, things like that, whatever it is, you're just playing roulette. Maybe in your lifetime you'll never have something, but maybe you will. And if you've lost all your photos and all your finance and all your... It's almost akin to identity theft or destruction. So it's $50, $60, $70 US. It's so worth the money to have CrashPlan. And my strategy is everything is on the home server. I never save anything to my local drive. So I'm a big fan. Microsoft has abandoned Windows Home Server, so I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do. I guess I'll have to go to the cloud. But at minimum, back up your stuff, CrashPlan. Other utilities, miscellaneous, 7-Zip. I use Visual Studio and Expression Web for web authoring. I purchased a CSS menu builder for my website. I use the CSS Definitive Guide from O'Reilly. That's probably too much detail. So let me close this. Services used. My web hosting is 1&1, the number 1, A&D, the number 1 web hosting. I'm on their Windows package. It includes multiple domains. And I have the one, of course, for the podcast and the email services. You know, it's interesting to me that, and I have somebody who reminds me of this all the time. I looked at my stats for last week, and during 1 week's time, there were 10,000 MP3s, 10,000 plus downloaded from my site for people listening to the current and the back catalog. And I've never once heard from... They say unlimited bandwidth, and most of the time that's a misnomer if you go with... Let me not pick on GoDaddy, but I can't think of a name. They tend not to honor that unlimited. It's kind of unlimited, but one in one, knock on wood, has never said anything to me. Services used, Facebook, YouTube, something called Cluster Maps. If you've ever been to our homepage, it just kind of shows the latest people logging in and where they've come from. PayPal, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, STITCHER, it's a podcasting company, Xbox Music, and formerly SkyDrive, it's now called OneDrive from Microsoft. I do exchange and backup and photos and stuff in the cloud with them. So I guess that's it from services, software, and hardware. And given that we're just over an hour here, it makes sense to get to some closing final thoughts, and let's close this down. So let's get to closing comments, and it could be noted that I've tried to start this about four times and deleted the content I said before. Now you get to live in the moment. So I'm at 13 pages of my bulleted notes to this point, and what else do I have to share? Just a couple things. I'm branching out with some of my one-on-one stuff going forward, meaning interviews. Doing this, like many other things, is a practical matter. It has to be said that it's difficult at times to just keep churning out content and building episodes. It's a lot of work. And I also think that I personally get tired of hearing me, and it's fun to explore the interview and conversational styles of content delivery. I see the show evolving to allow interviews to come in as part of adding. And I've done my fair share of interviews in other formats with my experience, and I like the pattern that comes with it. So I don't intend to stray too far from the roots, but to broaden, or differently say, diversify the show so it breathes. And the thing that I have to say about this is, change is good, but alienation is not. So I'll be balanced on this and see how well it's received. I don't think I'm going to take the show in a whole new direction, and you have to strike that balance between your visitors that come for something and going off in a complete different direction and alienating them. I'm not interested in that. So I mentioned it a second ago, metrics. One thing you should have in mind is keeping track of your metrics. I personally don't fuss on that. On web page hits and downloads and things like that. I mean, I mentioned just a second ago how many that I have, and honestly, I was shocked to see how many people are downloading it. I don't get too camera shy, you think, but it does give me pause and makes me take stock and say, hey, you know, there's a lot of people listening to this. Maybe you should be careful and take pride in the production value given people are counting on it. That's just the way I think about this and how I use the information. All right, I said I was getting to the point of wrap-up, so let's do that. In a typical Kevin fashion, this is probably more than you wanted to know, but if you're still here, hopefully this was an insightful and interesting look behind the scenes. If you somehow feel inspired to do a podcast on your own someday, best of luck, and I hope that what I shared can shortcut you in your journey to success. I suppose a logical question might be, what if I gave away all my secrets and someone starts a podcast to compete with me? I say, okay, no worries. You know, of course, I don't want anyone to parrot me or copy my ideas. I don't think that's useful for anyone. Go off and do your own thing. But I'm comfortable in my own shoes, and there's room for more. I won't begin to take credit for the great work that Gary has done over at the Kiwi Mana podcast, for example, but I've answered questions for him when he got started, and he's become a resource for me to collaborate with. So if you do go off, make sure you come back and keep a dialogue with me. For the listeners, I think it's a win-win situation in my eyes. I inherently want to believe in the good in anyone, and I'm a bit sentimental like that, and I'm willing to do something like this if it helps provide the insights to give perspective on what this is all about. I would like to take a moment to say thanks to my favorite podcasts and interviews. interviewers that inspired me when I got started. Windows Weekly, I never miss a show, ever. This American Life, it is the best radio program ever. I liked Evan Kleiman, Good Food. I don't listen to it anymore, but for a while, I really loved the format of that, and it inspired me at the beginning. National Public Radio, and I mentioned before, I'm a huge fan of Terry Gross. And more recently, I've been digging the Alton Brown cast. If you haven't listened to that, go subscribe to it. It's just all over the place. It's not literally about food, if you know who Alton Brown is. It's been a 4-year journey, and I've enjoyed it. There have been times when I ask myself what I'm doing, but overwhelmingly I've sat in anticipation of the future episode and what's next. Wait, Kevin Moment. What's next, Gary? Oh, that's a bit of an homage to Gary and Margaret if you don't get the reference from Kiwi Mana. I loved the episode when they were having fun with that. Okay, back to the task at hand. Even at the end, I can't help myself. I anticipate doing this for the foreseeable future and perhaps in conjunction with the podcast. I'm thinking about becoming a master beekeeper, and I could parlay this into something down the road. I guess time will tell where it runs its course, and that's the fun of it. So that's it. I hope that if you were waiting for this, it answered all your questions, but if not, feel free to send me an email, kevin@bkcorner.org. Thanks for spending time with the Beekeeper's Corner podcast today. Bye, everyone, and be well.